Hello, we're back once again with Railway Mania. I'm recording this in June 2019. It's the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings at the moment, and the subsequent invasion of Normandy by the Allied forces. So I thought it apt to do an episode focusing on the railway's involvement during the Second World War. The planning for this episode began as an overview of how the railways played a part in the liberation of France during World War II, but as with so many of these subjects, there is so much information around that I feel this could become part of a multi-part series based around the activities of the US Army Transportation Corps alone, so today we'll mainly focus on the build-up of forces in the UK before the invasion, and the landing in Normandy itself, and even then I'm mainly focusing around the US forces. To keep this podcast episode to a reasonable length, I've made some sweeping generalisations along the way that, while not totally accurate, will hopefully keep things moving along. Now, with the excuses out of the way, let's get started. This was the single biggest conflict in human history, and the numbers involved are truly staggering. Starting as I mean to go on, here's the first sweeping generalisation. Unlike the First World War, where it was unclear who the victors would be until the end, the outcome was fairly clear by 1942-1943. The expansion of the Axis powers in Europe had been brought to a halt in Russia and Africa, and the pushback had begun. This meant that Allied planners were able to spend quite some time thinking through the logistical requirements of the planned invasion. It was clear to them that trench warfare was a thing of the past. The static battle lines had been replaced by large-scale mechanised assaults. Flanking manoeuvres could bypass entire cities. What the Germans had learned to their cost in Russia was not lost on the Allies, that an army can only push forward and hold ground as long as the supply train can keep up. As soon as the food, ammunition and equipment stops arriving, attacks will falter and the chances of defeat increase substantially. By the time of D-Day in June 1944, the Allies were actually already in mainland Europe, having taken Sicily and were battling their way up through Italy. The large-scale Allied assault that would lead to Germany was to enter France through the Normandy Peninsula in the northwest of the country, followed by another invasion force landing in the south. Both army groups would put pressure on the Axis forces and push them back towards the Rhine River. What was clear was that a combined force of air, sea, road and rail would be required to keep the forces supplied and on the move. As far back as May 1941, 7 months before the surprise attack at Pearl Harbor, the American Army had created the Special Army Observer Group, which was sent to London to coordinate with the British, as it was clear that any American involvement in Europe would need to use Britain as a base of operations. A year later, the Services of Supply were formed, which would work in conjunction with the mighty US Army Transportation Corps. The British had been at war for over 2 years by this point, and pointed out that the massive influx of American troops and supplies would break the already strained transport network, and that the US Army would need to augment their existing resources. Something that I have to constantly remind myself, and I think for others who grew up in peacetime, they might also struggle to get their heads around this, the thing about a situation of total war is that absolutely everything is put on hold that is not directly related to the war effort. For the railways, there was a prohibition on building any passenger locomotives, for example. Heavy goods and shunters were what were needed to haul supplies. Not only that, but the railway works in Britain were also busy building vehicles and armaments, as well as the big goods engines. For example, London Transport had converted their works and were actually coordinating a group of companies building Halifax bombers. Quite a difference from underground trains. The shortage of locomotives was so severe that in early 1943 the British were cancelling over 1,000 trains a week as there were no engines to pull them. The Americans would need to bring their own trains if they wanted to use the railway. Not only that, they would also need to bring huge amounts of personnel. Consider that this was an age before containers were used to transport goods, something that we're so used to today. This was a time when every crate, every barrel, every vehicle had to be loaded and unloaded, sometimes by hand, sometimes one by one. There was a huge dependency on labour. Regarding locomotives, the British War Department had learned the lessons from the First World War. Between 1914 and 1918, the Railway Operating Division had started out with a hodgepodge of disparate designs, all commandeered to serve the armed forces. But during the course of the conflict, a standard goods locomotive type was adopted, a 280 almost identical to the Great Central Railway 8K class, with hundreds of them being built. Now, if you've ever seen a group of squaddies rebuild a Land Rover, then the benefits of a common design in an army environment should be obvious. Everybody knows what each part does, no matter what vehicle they're working on. Likewise, when the Second World War rolled round in 1939, a more modern 280 freight loco was chosen as the standard design. This was Stania's 8F, a powerful and efficient slogger. However, there were savings to be made in both material and construction time, so Robert Riddles's team stripped the 8F design of any frivolity, right back to the bare essentials. This resulted in the austerity, WD, or WD class, wound up being one of the largest single classes of locos in Britain, with 935 produced. It was somewhat tragic then that only one ended up being preserved, and that one came via Sweden. I guess that when something is so commonplace, its value is perhaps not recognised until it's too late. Back in the States, the USATC knew that they needed something homemade, but there was a problem. The loading gauge, which is the maximum width and height of a rail vehicle, in France is smaller than the USA, and in Britain it's even smaller still. An existing off-the-shelf design from one of the loco builders would likely be too large to work in the UK. Handily, the groundwork for a European-compatible design had already been laid before the war, and before America entered the conflict they had been supplying locomotives for use by the British forces in the Middle East via the Lend-Lease Agreement. The large goods engines were the S200 class, which was a 282 tender engine. Based on this design, Major J.W. Marsh from the Corps of Engineers developed the S160. A 280, smaller than the S200, this had the potential to operate on British railways as well as European ones. Aside from the smaller size, the S160 resembled a classic American freight loco in every way. A large, roomy cab was provided, with side windows rather than the Spartan cutouts so common on British engines. The tender ran on bogies rather than a fixed frame. The pipework and gubbins was all carried on the outside of the loco rather than being hidden by cladding, distinguishing the design from the British WD, and of course had the distinctive offset smokebox door in order to fit a massive air pump on the front for the brakes. As one observer said, they had all their innards on the outside. The USATC knew that the tracks the S160 would have to operate on would be in poor condition, so the front pair of driving wheels was sprung independently of the rear pair. These locos were provided with double buffers and the classic hook and chain couplings, rather than the more common centre knuckle couplings so familiar on US railroads. As a side note, the terms we use, like S200, S160, etc., were likely not used by the USATC, but were extrapolated by the author, R. Tourette, from some designations used by Olco. It helps us tell the designs apart, though, so I will keep using them here. As a reminder, the British WD numbered 935 examples, and was one of the largest single classes in Britain. Well, the American locomotive builders knocked out 2,120 S160s between them. The S160 ended up being used in over 20 different countries all over the world, including 60 examples that were sent in kit form to India to be built as broad gauge locos. Several variants were also used in Russia on the 5-foot gauge systems there. In Britain, 400 locos were delivered in two groups, partly under the Lend-Lease Agreement. The first 200 were put into service on Britain's railways, while the second group was placed in store in Wales, ready for the invasion. Jack Gardner, a Great Western Railway driver, is noted as praising the spacious cab, padded seats and full side windows with good visibility. There was, however, one unfortunate problem. The single water gauge for the boiler was of an unfamiliar design, and misreading of the water level resulted in three separate instances of boiler explosions within the space of 10 months. The worst of these was in November 1943, when a fireman on the GWR was scalded as the firebox crown collapsed due to this problem. Amazingly, he and the driver managed to get out and walk to the next signal box at Honeybourne, where the signalman gave first aid, but the extent of the fireman's injuries were not recognised in the blackout, and he sadly died. Other issues were often the result of the usual wartime economies, such as insufficient maintenance of the grease-lubricated axle boxes, which ended up with the boxes often running hot. Around 25 S160s survive today, with several at work on preserved railways. Much like the US Army Jeeps, they were not designed for long lives, but their numbers ensured their survival into preservation. As well as the large lumbering S160s, the American loco builders also constructed 382 small 060 tank engines, designated S100 and designed by Colonel Howard G. Hill. Like their bigger cousins, these shunters, or switchers to use the American term, were very distinct in appearance and would not have looked out of place stateside, where many in fact worked their entire lives. As with the S160s, they were narrow enough to work on the UK's network. I remember somebody telling me that the average life expectancy of a Willys Jeep in World War II was around 6 weeks use in the field. Similarly, the S100 was intended for a lifespan of only 5 years, but it's a testament to the robustness of the design that several were still at work in industrial use in the mid-2000s. In fact, the railways in Yugoslavia liked the design so much that after the war they copied and improved it to make their own version, the Class 62. In the UK, there are 4 of the original S100 type and 2 of the improved Class 62 preserved. Worldwide, there are over 100 intact examples over many countries including the USA, China and the former Yugoslavia. These weren't the only designs that came over from the States. Those that had worked on the narrow gauge trench railways in World War I were all too aware that the exhaust from steam locomotives acted as a beacon to any nearby aeroplanes or artillery observers. During that conflict, small petrol locos had been used close to the front lines. American development of and investment in diesel locos was at a comparatively advanced stage, and the Whitcomb Locomotive Company, a subsidiary of Baldwin, built several subclasses of Bobo, that's 2-powered bogies, road switcher engines. Road switcher may be an unfamiliar term to a British audience. In short, it's a locomotive equally suited to shunting or mainline work. The Whitcombs had a single cab in the middle of the loco with long bonnets at either end. While examples of this loco were used by the US Army and Navy, it was the British forces who were first to adopt the class. Here is a quote from the general manager of the Whitcomb Locomotive Company explaining how the order came about. During the latter part of 1940, we were asked to design a locomotive which could operate successfully through desert sandstorms and keep cool with a thermometer registering 125 Fahrenheit in the shade. That's 51 degrees Celsius. The only other known factors besides the gauge of track was that they needed all the power we could give them, but the weight had to be reduced to the absolute minimum. That is just about as contradictory as wanting the strength of a draft horse and a Shetland pony. Contradictory requirements from the army? Who could suggest such a thing? Whitcomb diesels were as much a part of the war effort as the S-100s and S-160s, and had a few claims to fame of their own. They powered the first Allied trains into liberated Rome and Paris, the first supply and hospital trains into Belgium, as well as the first train into Germany. While in the desert, the Whitcombs proved invaluable at being easy to disguise from air attack, as they produced far less exhaust smoke than the steam engines. Many were fitted with fake goods wagon-style bodies as camouflage. With the camouflage body on, the position of the loco within the train was constantly changed, so enemy pilots would not know which wagon to aim for. Of course, locomotives are useless if they've got no trains to pull. In Britain, the railways were still using Victorian-era-style wagons, mostly four-wheelers with limited capacity. As an example of this, the average American boxcar, basically a van body running on bogies, had a capacity of around 50 tonnes, whereas the average British four-wheeler could only carry 10. French stock was generally larger, but since the SNCF, the French railway system, was at the time in the service of Nazi Germany, that made it a target for the air forces and the resistance forces in the business of sabotage. The USATC knew that most of the SNCF stock would be blown to kingdom come during invasion time, and that they wouldn't be able to rely on capturing enough to run a railway system. Again, specially designed equipment was required and delivered. Of these, 700 flat wagons, 500 tank transporter wagons, and 42 refrigerated wagons were lent to the British Railways, on the deal that they would all have to be returned with 14 days' notice if needed. These wagons were shipped across the Atlantic in flatpack form, with just the underframes pre-assembled. Then, in England, a team of troops with rail-mounted cranes would lift the ends, sides, and roof into position and bolt it all together, like a one-to-one scale kit or an IKEA flatpack piece of furniture. This ensured that the transport ships weren't convoying across the ocean with wagons full of fresh air and that no space was wasted. So, we've now got an army that's loaded and ready to go. It has a supply chain all prepared. All it has to do now is cross about 100 miles of water into hostile territory. Operation Overlord itself has been written about thousands of times, so I won't go into the details of the invasion or the events of D-Day itself here. The transportation challenge begins once the troops are off the beach. There are no ports. We have hundreds of locomotives and thousands of wagons that need to get from ship to shore. How did they do that? Well, some of the first locos ashore were in fact British ones, tiny 040 diesel shunters built by Andrew Barclay. Their size was so small that they could be carried on tank transporter trucks, themselves loaded onto landing craft tanks or LCTs. These are the ships where they have a ramp on the front instead of a traditional bow. The ship rams into the beach, the ramp drops down, and the vehicles drive out. The best way I can describe an LCT is if you've ever seen the film Saving Private Ryan, the boats at the beginning of that film, during the Omaha beach scene, are called Landing Craft Vehicle and Personnel, or LCVP. The military is simply the best for catchy and easy to remember names. LCVPs can carry a couple of jeeps or a group of soldiers. LCTs are essentially larger versions that can carry a couple of lorries. Four of the Barclay Diesels came ashore via this method, two at Juneau Beach in the Canadian sector and two at Utah Beach in the US area. The lorry just drove down the ramp, up the beach, carrying the loco and unloaded it directly onto the railway line. Several of these little shunters survive today, including one at the Avon Valley Railway near Bristol. It's called Grumpy, rather apt really. The nature of the invasion and the subsequent Battle of Normandy dictated the type of transport that was required. While in the early stages of the build-up in the UK, trucks and road transport had been used as sparingly as possible, the fact that after Operation Overlord the front line was not far from the beach meant that lorries were the dominant form of supply. There simply would be no economy in using rail transport while the army was held up in Normandy during June and the early stages of July. However, the breakout was imminent, and what would follow was a rapid drive across France. The Transportation Corps needed to lay its hands on a decent landing site that didn't involve a substantial drive to the nearest railhead. In the American sector, this was the port of Cherbourg, on the northern coast of Normandy. Once captured, Cherbourg was in a terrible state. The docks had been bombed from the air, and ships had been sunk and wrecked in the harbour itself, sometimes deliberately to prevent the Allies from making use of the dock facilities. The engineers were adept at overcoming the situation. Sometimes they would construct dock facilities on top of the sunken ships, using them as a bridge to the quayside. But the solution for getting trains ashore was even better. The LCT's big brother, the landing ship tank or LST, was used here. These resembled conventional ships in size but retained doors in the bow or the ramp that dropped down. Several had been adapted to carry rail wagons. At the north part of the docks there was enough space for six LSTs to dock simultaneously. The fact that the doors were at the front meant that the ships take up the minimum amount of shoreline compared to a conventional quayside because they go side by side. Multiple sidings were laid down to the beach, bypassing the smashed port facilities. Where the rails met the water's edge, a small metal prefabricated girder formed a jetty, almost like half a bridge. This girder unit could be rolled out and extended into the water, as well as being adjustable in height. At high tide, the LST would be driven up to the jetty, and the rails were connected to those inside the ship. Wagons could be rolled down the ramp, onto the track, and hauled into service straight away. This works fine with bogie wagons that can cope with the sudden changes in gradient, but it wasn't reasonable to rely on a ramp to be able to deal with the large fixed wheelbase of an engine, or the weight. An S-160 weighs over 70 tonnes. Something more substantial was required. There were two larger ships, the Sea Trains Lakehurst and Texas. What made these special was that they had rail lines laid from end to end in the hold, with what resembled a slot cut into the top of the ship, from where a large crane would quickly grab a vehicle at a time and lift it off the ship, slide it sideways over the dock and lower onto the railway tracks, a bit like how a container ship works today. These were great, but the destroyed docks meant that the ship's onboard cranes or derricks had to be used, which were almost as slow as a conventional ship in unloading. A secret weapon was needed, and this arrived in the form of the T.S. Hampton Ferry. This was a specialised train ferry owned by the Southern Railway, with an opening at the stern where rail vehicles could be shunted in and out of the hold, much like road vehicles drive onto more modern ferries. In peacetime, this supplied the English Channel carrying goods or passengers from Dover to Dunkirk. She had already been hard at work in the war effort. Apart from operating as a troop transport, she had spent some time being used as a mine layer. In June 1944, the Hampton Ferry was modified with an enormous gantry at the stern, which jutted out 35 feet beyond the rear of the ship. As soon as possible, a more substantial rail-connected jetty was built at Cherbourg, which the Hampton Ferry would reverse up to. The huge gantry would then lift locomotives off the ship and onto the jetty. All of the S-160s were ready to go, the boilers had water in them and the tenders were full of coal. There was clearly no time to waste. The ship could carry 16 S-160s at a time and could deliver them far faster than a dockside crane can unload them from a normal ship, which would have had to carry the locos as deck cargo. The Hampton Ferry's gantry could also turn the locos around mid-air before setting them down. The same gantry crane was also fitted to her sister ships Twickenham Ferry and Shepperton Ferry. The trains were in Europe now, and the fight was on. chosen to end this episode here, as I could go on and on, but I'd never get it finished. At a later time, I'll record some more facts about the USATC and the WD railways in World War II, and hopefully unearth more stories. A little bit more info on the Hampton Ferry. Whilst it was a British vessel, it had a secondary crew of 18 American servicemen, whose sole priority was to keep this loading and unloading operation going. They looked after the gear, did all the greasing, and adjusted the straps for loading. These troops were under the direct command of the captain. The Hampton Ferry retained the gantry until 1947, when it's converted back to its civilian configuration. It carried on working until 1969, and was finally laid to rest in 1973. As always, I hope that this episode was both educational and enjoyable. Please do check out the other episodes if you hadn't heard them already. The website address is railwaymania.net. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Please do get in touch if you have any questions or fact checks. Thanks for listening, and I hope to return with more Railway Mania soon.